From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Dialogue is an exchange about culture, straight from the soul. You can catch us on Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. This week, the host of Illinois Public Media's The Mid-American Gardener show, Tanisha Spain, joins us on Dialogue as an interviewer and host. She's sitting down with experts to discuss all things related to mental health in the Black community, with a special focus on Black girls and women. In the first part of our conversation, Tanisha is speaking with experts on suicide in the Black community. She's joined by Dr. Deidre Weathersby, Associate Director and Licensed Clinical Psychologist at the University of Illinois Counseling Center, and Dr. Kamau Grantham, Licensed Clinical Psychologist and Co-Chair of SANCOPA, which is the Black Student Outreach Team at the Counseling Center at the University of Illinois. And then Tanisha sits down with Dr. Deidre Weathersby one-on-one to discuss what depression looks like in the Black community and how it's affecting Black girls and women. Later on, I have a conversation with Dr. Stephanie Cockrell from The Well Experience in Urbana about their social services for women and girls. Stay tuned on Dialogue. This conversation with Tanisha Spain is coming up next.
This week, we're going to tackle a tough mental health topic, and I want to offer a trigger warning to those who may be sensitive. We're going to be discussing suicide in the Black community.
If you or someone you know is in a crisis, you can call the National Lifeline at 988.
According to the Suicide Prevention Resource Center, suicide attempts among Black people are on the rise. The CDC also reports that race and age also factor into those rising numbers after years of decline. Joining me for this very important dialogue are Dr. Deidre Weathersby, Associate Director and Licensed Clinical Psychologist at the University of Illinois. Welcome, Deidre.
Thanks for having us.
Also on the line with us is Dr. Kamau Grantham, Licensed Clinical Psychologist and Co-Chair of SANCOPA, which is the Black Student Outreach Team at the Counseling Center at the University of Illinois. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, I mentioned those stats above in the introduction, and Dr. Grantham, we'll start with you. What are some of the factors that are behind this troubling trend that we're seeing?
You know, I think it's hard to pinpoint on any one particular factor. But I think there are a lot of things included. So there are things called adverse childhood experiences. So domestic violence can play a role, financial hardships, grief and loss. We definitely know racial discrimination and racial trauma impacts Black folks' mental health. We know also not seeking mental health services as well, right? So there are people that could be dealing with suicide and suicidal thoughts that aren't going to get help. Of course, it's all very individualized.
Gotcha. And let's dive into some of those mental health services as it relates to Black America. And Deidre, I'll ask this question to you. You know, those services have not always been accessible to Black communities for a host of reasons. So talk a little bit about those barriers and some of those stigmas that we see.
A number of barriers. You know, research shows, particularly for Black men and Black folks in general, they may prefer to see a Black therapist. And what we do know is that in the field, about 4% of the field of licensed clinical psychologists are Black in this country. And so that is an obvious barrier. And access, right? Healthcare, unfortunately, we would love to do. I know Kamau and I both do community service and pro bono, but we also make a living, and folks having the ability to pay even a sliding scale or have the health insurance available that will cover mental health services can also be a barrier in our community. And then you hit the nail on the head there, Tanisha, is the stigma attached? Mm-hmm. How often do we talk about it in our families and destigmatize that and normalize taking care of our overall health and particularly our mental health?
And Kamau, you talked about this last week when we were sort of putting this discussion together. What does it mean to have someone who looks like you offering mental health services? And does it matter? Does that factor into a person's willingness to do the work, their willingness to seek help? Talk a little bit about that.
I think it really depends. Well, I always think representation does matter. So seeing someone that looks like you, particularly when seeking mental health services, I think that matters. But it also has to do with preference. And so there's mixed research out there. There's some research out there to show, depending on a Black person's level of racial identity development, that may impact their preference for a therapist. Some people may prefer to see someone that looks like them. Other people may not have any thoughts or feelings about that. So I think it's individualized. Perception is also important. If someone sees a therapist that looks like them or a mental health provider that looks like them, and they believe that that person will understand where they're coming from, I think that makes a difference. And so I know sometimes we won't seek services because we feel like we're not represented. I think sometimes that we can do ourselves a disservice. But I also understand, given the history of Black folks and mental health services in this country, why folks would be shy or reluctant to see someone that doesn't look like them.
And with regard to services, and I'll just throw this out there to either one of you, are we in what would be considered as a mental health desert? You mentioned 4% nationally, but, you know, Central Illinois, downstate Illinois, is this a mental health desert for people of color, for Black services?
I'm going to shy away from maybe using the term desert. Just tagging along to Dr. Grantham's statement is we don't want to cause any more barriers to people seeking help. And here in Central Illinois, we actually have a fair amount of clinicians that are in private practice or connected to services through group services or the university. So I think that they are out there. You can find that community, look on websites. And so I would say that there could be limited services, but I believe that they're out there and openings out there in order to take advantage of services.
I agree. I'll also add in, with the advancements in telehealth, that's also another option. And so if someone would prefer to see a provider in the Chicago area, they can do that through telehealth as well.
I want to take a moment to remind listeners you are currently listening to Dialogue on Illinois Soul. I'm Kennedy Vincent. This week, Illinois Public Media's reporter and host Tanisha Spain sat down to speak with experts on suicide in the Black community. She's joined by Dr. Deidre Weathersby, Associate Director and Licensed Clinical Psychologist at the University of Illinois Counseling Center, and Dr. Kamau Grantham, licensed clinical psychologist and co-chair of SANCOPA, which is a Black student outreach team at the Counseling Center at the University of Illinois. Stay tuned as their conversation resumes in a moment.
In preparing for our discussion, you know, I was looking up stats, and according to the Office of Minority Health, and they use data from 2019 and before as kind of a benchmark to really illustrate the increase in these suicide numbers. And, you know, there's no mistaking that a lot has happened between 2019 and 2024. You know, most notably, we've got the murder of George Floyd, the pandemic. There's a lot of stuff crammed into those years. And anything to say about those years and its effect on Black mental health?
I know that we often refer to that time as multiple pandemics, to remind folks that, yeah, we had COVID-19 and a huge epidemic that threatened our health. But in the Black community, we were disproportionately impacted by COVID-19, not just because we had more loss, the obvious, less access to vaccines and information. And that got better over time. But also we were dealing with things that have been around for decades. It wasn't new. People and folks that identified like us racially suffered tremendously from threats and death and that trauma and vicarious and real trauma. But it was impacted, I think, by COVID-19 and having to experience all of that at once. That's a real event that I think we're still recovering from individually and collectively.
Kamau, anything to add on that?
Yeah, to Deidre's point, I mean, we're talking about decades, and I would even just say centuries, right? We've been dealing, when you look at historical trauma, and I know we might talk about that in a little bit, you know, we've been dealing with stuff, Black folks, we've been dealing with things since day one. And so I think all of these things kind of build up over time. And if people don't have healthy ways for managing all of this stress and anxiety and trauma, I think folks can turn to suicide. And in my experience, you know, people that are experiencing suicidal ideation, in many ways, they do not want to die, but feel like they have no other options. They feel like they have no hope. They're not sure what else to do. And so I think when people are in those kind of situations, suicide seems like a reasonable option. And again, particularly for Black folks, talking about all of the trauma that we've been experiencing, the multiple pandemics, the generations, the centuries of discrimination and oppression, all of that stuff adds up. And again, not everyone has the tools to kind of manage that.
And if folks don't know that, you know, what I'm hearing you both talk about is just the compounding of different things on top of an already, you know, challenging situation that Black Americans face. But let's dive into the definition of racial trauma. I would love to hear from a clinical perspective, what is racial trauma for those who may not be familiar with that term?
It's trauma experienced from being oppressed. And what we know by research and race-related stress that can lead to trauma is that you suffer from it whether or not you acknowledge it, mm-hmm. right? So there is systemic levels of racism. There's individual racism, the insidious things that happen to us every day through microaggressions. And some folks think, oh, you know, I don't feel like that bothers me or doesn't impact me. Well, what research shows through the World Health Organization that our quality of life is absolutely impacted negatively, whether we acknowledge it or not. So I think we just need to all kind of start with that assumption, is that we're all impacted.
Who is most at risk in our community? When you look, you know, and we're not a monolith, we've heard that, but when we're looking at the Black community as a whole, who is most at risk? Who do we need to pay special attention to and look out for?
In terms of who's most at risk, I think we're all most at risk, but definitely those in our community that are most vulnerable. So folks from the LGBTQ plus community, I think children are also very vulnerable. And as far as, you know, warning signs, you know, I just want to clarify. So mental health is along the lines of a continuum, right? It's not either you're dealing with mental health issues or you're not. It's like we're all managing this on some level. It's not an either or situation. I think we all need to work on being more self-aware and being in tune with ourselves, what we're feeling, how we're behaving. Some possible warning signs could be, and again, I like to talk about like frequency and intensity, right? So I think we're all going to have bad days or feel angry or feel anxiety or stress. That's normal. I think you want to watch out for frequency and intensity, meaning how often are these things happen and how much of it is it negatively impacting our lives. And I would just say specifically, you know, warning signs for suicide, for example, I would look at significant changes in behavior. Again, significant changes. Sometimes folks might start giving away prized possessions, things that are important to them. They might start giving those things away. Maybe they're making statements, saying things like they're wishing they weren't here or wishing they would die. Sometimes people are researching ways to die. Folks might make statements that they feel like they're a burden to other people. They might be engaging in kind of like risky behavior. So I think just kind of keeping a lookout. But again, that's like the extreme. I think we also need to be watching out for each other and ourselves just in general, so it doesn't get to this point.
And Dr. Weathersby, what advice do you have for caretakers to approach this discussion, to open the door for a loved one, to ask them if they're okay? How do you start that?
You know, it can be really simple. Sometimes we can overthink things. And if folks are struggling, they'll tell you. They'll tell you with their behavior and their words that they're struggling. So I think we just need to listen and be present, because we're not having discussions genuinely about how are you doing, not just in the hallway, like a tag, bye, don't really listen, but just genuinely wanting to know, how are you doing? Being mindful, how's it going? How are you doing? And oftentimes, I'm gonna just be real, we're talking about the Black community. We may suspect things and then not approach it. It's a myth to think that, well, if I mention suicide or self-harm or do you want to kill yourself, I may be putting that in their head. And that's simply not true. You know, folks that are struggling want someone to see them.
I think we also do. We also want to be mindful. Sometimes in our community, we internalize this idea that we have to be strong all the time. And so we feel like we have to push through the pain. And again, I think that can be detrimental to our own mental health, is that often we're pushing through very difficult things, and it doesn't make you less of a person. It doesn't make you less Black or less strong if you need to ask for help. I actually think it's a sign of strength to be that in tune with yourself, to recognize there's something that I need help with and to get and go get help for that. I think that is a sign of strength.
Finally, I want to ask both of you, you know, we've seen the numbers decline before. And there is no one answer, like you said earlier in our discussion, but how do we start to peel back some of these layers so that these numbers of Black suicide, again, will be on the decline? You talked about the multiple pandemics. So is it just an all hands on deck approach to really just peeling this away one layer at a time as a community?
Oh, I like that idea, Tanisha, one layer at a time. And as a preventionist, I do think that we all need to be involved. This isn't just the job of a mental health professional or clinician, but our families can do, we can do our part in families of having resources available. If nothing else, just call 988, which is the non-emergency hotline for suicide or other mental health distress. You know, or knowing where the resources are within local schools and school counselors, and being willing to maybe help someone.
Any final thoughts there, Kamau?
Yeah, I mean, I think increased suicide, that is a symptom of a larger problem. So I think addressing some of the larger systemic problems that we've mentioned, right? The racial trauma, systemic racism, I think that's the bigger issue. And as far as what we can do as a community, again, I think as individuals and within our families, making sure that we're taking care of ourselves, looking after each other, normalizing mental health services, normalizing getting help, starting as individuals within our families, within our communities, that's a start. But again, you know, it's hard if, you know, someone keeps poking holes in your boat, you know, you doing your best to cover the holes, but if no one was poking holes in the boat, we wouldn't have the problems. You know what I'm saying? So I think there are larger systems in place that need fixing. But I think for us to continue to take care of ourselves.
Dr. Deidre Weathersby, Associate Director and Licensed Clinical Psychologist at the University of Illinois, and Dr. Kamau Grantham, Licensed Clinical Psychologist and Co-Chair of SANCOFA, which is the Black Student Outreach Team Counseling Center at the University of Illinois. Thank you both so much for your time and talents, and I think this is the first of many conversations that we'll be having.
Thank you for having us.
If you or someone you know is in a crisis, you can call the National Lifeline at 988. Coming up next on Dialogue, we're continuing our conversation on Black women and mental health. Illinois Public Media's reporter and host Tanisha Spain sat down with Dr. Weathersby. Once again, this time one-on-one to discuss depression and how it impacts Black women and girls. Stay with us on Dialogue after this short break. From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Dialogue is an exchange about culture, straight from the soul. You can catch us on Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. On today's episode, we are discussing mental health in the Black community, especially how it impacts Black women and girls. Earlier in the show, we heard from two professionals, Dr. Grantham and Dr. Weathersby, from the Counseling Center at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, about how suicide impacts the Black community. Now, Illinois Public Media's host and reporter Tanisha Spain sat down with Dr. Weathersby one-on-one to talk about how depression shows up in the lives of Black women and ways our community can manage it. Content warning. This episode contains conversations on mental health topics such as depression and suicide. If you or someone you know is in a crisis, you can call the National Lifeline at 988.
Depression can look different in different people. The way it affects a person's mood, personality, and overall well-being can be hard to spot. But in women, specifically Black women, it can be even harder, making today's dialogue an important one for women of color. Today we're talking about Black girl depression, and I've asked Dr. Deidre Weathersby, Associate Director for Outreach and Prevention and licensed clinical psychologist at the University of Illinois, to come on and discuss this topic with us.
We know that statistically we're more prone to physical diseases that are exacerbated by mental health concerns like anxiety and depression, things like high blood pressure, right? Diabetes, all those things can be enhanced or intensified by underlying mental health issues and vice versa.
Dr. Weathersby, thank you so much for coming back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So this is, you know, we've all come to know the sort of the idea of the strong Black woman. But when it comes to mental health, you know, that can translate to something not so great, maybe suffering in silence. Talk about the history and the dynamic that this has created and the pressures that it puts on Black women.
Well, historically, I'll just briefly say that internalizing emotions and learning not to emote was part of a survival package. My mother herself grew up in Southern Mississippi and was born in the 30s and certainly grew up in the 40s and 50s, where you could not publicly display strong emotions, and it could be life-threatening or something else. And so it was certainly a survival tactic, something that was necessary. And oftentimes how that translates, you know, in everyday workplace or at school, if certain emotions are displayed, then they oftentimes get misunderstood. We're talking about Black women. Is she too aggressive? Is she too angry? We can't win for losing almost. And so I just want to briefly say that we've never really grown up in a society or an environment here in the U.S. where the spectrum of emotions was met with affirming attitudes in the same way that maybe women from other populations or might have been afforded.
And, you know, on top of that, we're so big into this grind culture. Mm-hmm. Pushing through and persevering and securing the bag and just always keeping it moving, you know, and that's fine. It's, you know, on one hand, you can be driven, but does that leave room, like you said, for processing and self-care? And, you know, how do you do both? How do you manage both of those?
I think that finding spaces where you can feel safe being vulnerable, because I want to put that out there, that we don't want everybody trying this at home, you know, without having particular ways to process, whether that's with a mental health professional or a trusting family member, because we need to be real that in some spaces, it may not be safe to show and demonstrate your entire realm of emotion. And it doesn't mean you shouldn't. It just means that it may not always be safe. And so I think we need to practice it like anything else that you want to get good at. To have a good, sound emotional intelligence takes practice. It takes having authentic conversations and taking risk in those conversations and saying, you know, it really made me sad when this happened, or I'm not sure how I, you know, maybe you don't know how you feel. I'm not sure how I feel about it. And allowing somebody maybe time, if they're an internal processor, to figure out how they feel about something without projecting on them how they should feel. Everyone reacts differently and their expressions are valid.
And I'm guessing that's a muscle that you have to sort of work out, right?
Especially. Absolutely.
If you're used to it.
Mm-hmm. They actually have emotional wheels, right? Wellness wheels, where it's dozens of emotions on there that you can try on and describe. And does this fit? And am I feeling pensive, or am I feeling excited or happy? And you know, we're pretty complicated as humans. We can hold a lot of emotions at once. You could be deeply mourning, you know, the loss of a loved one, and then also be excited at the same time about something else that's happening, and irritated with someone at the, you know, so we can hold more than one emotion at a time, and figuring out those layers. Of course, it takes practice and exercising that, and giving yourself space and time and to reflect.
You know, when I initially reached out to you for this discussion, I had just watched a clip about Black girl depression and Black woman mental health. And Michelle Williams, one of the members from Destiny Child, has famously talked about her mental health. And she said something that I thought was so profound.
Including former Destiny's Child singer Michelle Williams, who speaks openly about her history of depression and says mental health struggles can look different in women of color.
Irritability is a missed symptom of depression because we think depression is just sadness. Once I started getting in therapy more consistently, it started giving me language to everything that I internalized, but I just didn't know what to say.
So there's strength in vulnerability.
There is strength in vulnerability. I can't tell you how strong you are when you can say, I need help, versus thinking your strength is acting out. Because the quality of life is so much better when you're not triggered all the time.
You know, sometimes people get caught up in thinking depression is crying or laying in bed. And it can look different in Black women. And that just blew me away. We haven't always had that space to be safe, to cry. So tell me a little bit more about that. What can depression look like in Black women?
Well, I just want to say that the DSM, which is the Diagnostic Statistical Manual that we use for diagnosis, you know, it wasn't normed off of Black women. And so, you know, often it was the white population. And so that's how depression was expressed. Oftentimes with Black women, depression is expressed physically. We might show up to the doctor and say, I'm having stomach issues, right? And so that's why more and more doctors are being taught to ask about depression and ask, how are you doing? Physical. So not only physically, yes, irritable. We might show irritability. You know, we can be depressed and show up for work every day because we don't have the same luxury to stay at home. And so are we taking less time for self-care or our appearance? Are there shifts in our behavior? Is there an intense emotion underlying or covering up some of the sadness? And so I think we just have to be mindful of what behaviorally might be going on with us, relationally, what's going on with our relationships, environmentally. I think all of those areas can speak to us and lead us to understand how someone might be manifesting depression in the Black community, with Black women particularly.
And you mentioned how sometimes the symptoms look different or show up in the body, or we will say, you know, I have a stomach ache. Does that contribute to either underdiagnosis and or misdiagnosis in Black women?
Sure, to both. We know that statistically we're more prone to physical diseases that are exacerbated by mental health concerns like anxiety and depression, things like high blood pressure, right? Diabetes, all those things can be enhanced or intensified by underlying mental health issues, and vice versa. And so we want to be sure that we are, I say that a mental health check-in should be part of our routine as readily as brushing our teeth and flossing every day. We should be checking in.
Now, this younger generation, they are, at least in my experience, they are more expressive about how they feel. I love that, because they're, you know, we talked about suffering in silence earlier in the conversation. These younger women, Black women, are not doing that. So what is contributing to this now? You know, folks are seeking treatment and getting help and talking about what's going on in their life. And that's a great thing. But how have we sort of broken out of that cycle of suffering and silence?
I love it. I think we're learning a lot from our younger folks. We're evolving as a people. You know, I want to give credit to my grandmother and mother for paving the way. And then each generation, I think, is becoming less stigmatized around mental health. And so certainly Gen Z is out there talking about it on social media, having mental health sessions right on social media. And so it's given us an opportunity to allow them the space and time like that, but to also not turn down invitations to those parties, right? Mental health check-in parties that they're having.
I was blessed. My mother has been a psych RN, and that gave me the language to say, I am sad. I am upset. That hurt me. So I, like you, would like to, you know, pay homage to the women in my family for giving that language and giving me that space to feel what I felt and to be able to process things. Lastly, if someone is listening to this conversation, a Black woman is listening to this conversation, or anyone, honestly, and they see themselves and something you've said has resonated with them and they think, wow, I could benefit. What's something that you say to people who are apprehensive about services, or at least just saying out loud, maybe I'm depressed, maybe I have anxiety? How do you get people to break beyond that fear of talking to someone or talking about it?
I think we meet people where they are with no judgment. You know, if you're not ready to commit to an ongoing, consistent regimen of a mental health process and professional, but maybe you're willing to go to a gym and a support group, then do that. Maybe you're willing to do a knitting circle with your mom and aunties and talk about things, but not quite ready for a mental health professional. I mean, as a psychologist, I'm going to say I would love for everyone to get to that point if they're willing. But if not, there are other resources and places where healing can take place. Certainly, if there is an ongoing mental health issue, I'm going to say, get help, dial 988, go to a medical professional and say, I want to check to see if I have depression and get a referral that way. And we want to surround folks and applaud them for opening up and saying that they do and destigmatizing it. Don't say, oh, you know, how we can sometimes. Nobody talks about that person that may be seeking mental health, but actually applaud them. That's great. I want to hear more about your story. And can I help you get the help? And maybe them getting help will allow you to open up and say, you know, I've found out things about relatives. And maybe you find out that an auntie was on antipsychotic medication decades ago and never knew how to talk about it. And so I think we just need to applaud folks for opening up those discussions and being willing. That's a sign of real strength.
And that goes back to what you talked about earlier, finding that safe space where it's okay to say those things and talk about how you feel and what's on your mind.
Yes. And then being that safe space for someone else. If we could all take that commitment, then we'd be better off.
Excellent advice there. Dr. Deidre Weathersby, Associate Director for Outreach and Prevention and Licensed Clinical Psychologist at the University of Illinois. Thank you so much for speaking with us about this very important dialogue today.
Thanks for having me again.
That was Illinois Public Media's reporter and host, Tanisha Spain, speaking with Dr. Deidre Weathersby about depression and how it affects Black women. You're listening to Dialogue on the all-new Illinois Soul, and we're taking a quick break on this conversation about mental health in the Black community. If you or someone you know is in a crisis, you can call the National Lifeline at 988. Up next, I'll be speaking with Stephanie Cockrell from the Well Experience in Urbana. Stay with us on Dialogue. From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Dialogue is an exchange about culture, straight from the soul. You can catch us on Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul. In the first portion of this episode, IPM reporter and host Tanisha Spain sat down with mental health experts to discuss mental health topics like depression and suicide in the Black community. If you or someone you know is in a crisis, you can call the National Lifeline at 988. Now, I'm speaking with Dr. Stephanie Cockrell. She's an author, a recent graduate with a doctorate in developmental psychology, and the executive director for the Well Experience. She has over 15 years' experience in the family service and support industry, and 10 years in various public education spaces. The Well Experience is located in Urbana. They support the growth of minority families, women, and the youth in our community, providing a healing-centered engagement and many resources, including therapeutic support to help families. She's dedicated her purpose and work to racial equity, and today we'll be speaking about different injustices our community faces and how her work provokes real change and healing within the family dynamic. We now welcome Dr. Stephanie Cockrell to Dialogue. Dr. Cockrell, you have created such an incredible community space. What inspired you to do this work and create the Well Experience?
I grew up in Springfield. We moved to Springfield when I was around 9 or so. And so I spent a majority of my life there before leaving there. And so I guess I wouldn't accredit it to the place as in Springfield per se, but more accredited to my life experiences. The experiences that I had really let me know that it's very necessary for women and young people and families to have a safe space. And I noticed how important the safe space is for mothers really helps to further develop the family with all of the things that have happened and that continue to happen to uproot the family. A lot of my research is surrounded around how creating safe spaces for Black women and girls can help to change the trajectory of the family. So it is very important. Black women are a huge key in supporting the connection of what the family is supposed to look like. And I'm really embedded in research. And that's what my doctoral research was really concerning, was all about how the, not just slavery, but things that happened through slavery and even the context of the Willie Lynch letter were designed to utilize women to destroy the Black man and destroy the home and destroy the family. So now if we are going to redo those things, I want to use research to recreate that wholeness and use women now to restore Black men, restore children, and really restore the home. And I think the safe spaces like this are key and very important to creating that space and actually healing the Black home.
I want to dive into that a little bit more. You mentioned from your research, you found that they were trying to use the Black woman to destroy the Black man. Tell us more about that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So everything, I don't know if you've ever read the Willie Lynch letter, but I actually designed a lot of my research around tearing that letter, taking that letter apart piece by piece and seeing how they wanted, and even just the systemic issues where women were able to get more support if the man was at home. And even when you think about public assistance and how we're wondering why our children are where they are, but I strongly believe that the stronger the family is, and when the family structure is restored to the way it was meant to be, that you're gonna have children being restored and returning to the way they should be. And it's just been a lot of challenges with the children and the home and the family. And I know there are people that disagree with me on that, but I have definitely seen and witnessed that with the safe spaces we've created at the Well, we have watched families restore. We have watched children change. We're not only, we provide a holistic support. So if we get your children then the family is automatically allowed to and connected to resources, connected to mental health services, social emotional learning, group therapeutic sessions, women's sessions that are just amazing, you know, and the women and girls and the youth here, the children are always rave and are thankful for the services and support they receive at the Well Experience. We have become a very vital, crucial part of family sustainability in this community.
What are you seeing? What are some of the biggest needs? And how are you helping families reshape what a healthy family structure can look like in healing?
Kennedy, honestly, the truth is it hasn't changed much. Poverty is still overtaking. Black families are being put into spaces where it's more like if you are put in a cage, you know, you're put in this space where there really isn't any, there aren't any resources, there aren't enough resources to serve and to support the families. There aren't enough jobs, there isn't enough money. There isn't enough village, you know, the village support is no longer there. And so it's crumbling from the inside out. And we've watched it over and over. And like when the children and the families come to us, we have heard some of the same stories happening and replaying again and again. And it's like, okay, what do we do about this housing? You know, what do we do about the number of homeless families that we are constantly working with, or the families who are on the verge of eviction, you know, and how do we allocate community dollars to supporting those families and helping them and doing what we can to see them really succeed and grow? And so those kind of things have not changed for years. I mean, and when I say it have not changed, I want to say, yes, there have been many efforts to help and support that. But as the population still continues to grow, I believe that it is still a very important issue and concern for us to consider. How can we best support families, and what's the best way to utilize tax dollars and community funding to really help families in these crises?
How do you get more involved in local advocacy? Is it going to city meetings? Is it researching where tax dollars are going? What are you doing?
Yes, I absolutely attend city meetings. On June 24th, we will be at the City of Urbana Council meeting to speak concerning the new police station they're building and the tax dollars that are going towards that. And just some of the things that have been stated about the number of Black families, Black people that are being arrested, and how our families feel about this coming into our community. Yes, we're talking about how they can allocate some more of those funds towards mental health and resources, and less funds to increasing the police department, you know? And it's not as though we're saying decrease safety. We're saying increase awareness, increase their ability to serve people with equity, increase their ability to provide mental health support and the supports that would and resources that would eliminate some of the crime they continue to talk about. And so, yes, those are definitely the things that we will be there to discuss.
Over time, what do you think some factors have been in regards to the decline of the village? Because we all know the saying, it takes a village. And that's emphasizing that a child's upbringing is a communal effort.
So I love the village. And so, of course, I love talking about the village. I will say, okay, so we're talking about the number of men who are no longer in the home, the breakdown of the family structure, then mothers who are working so much that, you know, they have to keep food on the table. They're working hours and there are no community programs that are supporting, I mean, not enough supporting kids. I look at the community organization that I have and the few others that I know about in the community, like Urbana Neighborhood Connection or Dream and other community organizations that are around here. And the truth is, if all of us served 200 to 300 kids, there's still thousands on the street. Okay. When we think about the population of the schools here in Champaign and Urbana, there are so many kids that still need to be supported, and families have to do what they have to do to keep food on the table, you know? And if the decision is between, do I work extra hours? Do I work long hours and keep a roof over my head? Or do I, you know, work short hours and risk me and my kids being homeless? It's a, you know, so our kids are spending more time by themselves. We need more community support that, you know, would be able to help support families in those areas. We have become the village for so many families, and I love it. Families, I always tell me, you know, Miss Stephanie, I'm so happy to have you as part of my village. And they know that we're not just watching children. We're supporting them. We are in the schools. We're advocating for youth and families. We are attending IEP meetings with our families. We're doing whatever we can to make sure families know that we are a part of the village. Then on top of that, we are also providing crisis support for our families, where we have a crisis line number where families can call, and our trained crisis management team is there to support and help. So it's just like the village is suffering right now. And honestly, there are also the group of people that have went to the kind of, what they say, me, my foe, and no mo. You know, it's just like, I'm going to take care of me and mine and not as concerned about others. And that is disheartening. And it has hurt. It has hurt our community. The Black community thrived and on unity and connectedness, where we're all striving to maintain the unity in our community. And it takes all of us, you know, in order to do that. The kids always talk about us building our own Wakanda. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
And it's like, in order to do that, it takes everybody saying, we want to work together to build a better community for our children and for our families. So my grandmother used to say, we've got too many people who get all they can all they get, and sit on the can. And if you're sitting on it and you've closed it, then you've not only closed it, then you've closed it to the people around you, but you've closed those that information and those resources to so many people that you can help and you can benefit. And I think that's another place where I come in, where I have been, you know, I've worked on so many things and figured out some ways to serve. And now I feel like with what I've been given and my own experiences, I have to take those experiences back in and support and help someone else. And so, And I'm not saying that, you know, I'm like some savior that came to, you know, to fix it all. So please don't say that, because it takes all of us working together. And so I am a piece of the puzzle. The well is a piece of the puzzle here to help, to see if we can help in rebuilding the family structure and lowering the community violence and doing what we can to support families.
And I hear you when we're talking about the village. It is key components like unity and teamwork and openness and all these different things. Thank you, Ms. Stephanie, for all the incredible work you're doing in the community and all the healing and new perspectives that you're bringing to Champaign-Urbana.
Thank you, Kennedy. I appreciate it.
If you'd like to get in touch or volunteer with The Well Experience in Urbana, you can go to thewellexperience.org. The dialogue team would like to thank our guests, Dr. Deidre Weathersby, Dr. Kamau Grantham, and Dr. Stephanie Cockrell. A very special thank you to our guest host, Tanisha Spain, today. If you're interested in listening to more episodes of Dialogue, you can go to illinoisoul.org, and you can now find the Dialogue podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube Music. And follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Illinois Soul. Dialogue's executive producers are Nidhi Shastri, Penny Bradford, and myself, Kennedy Vincent. Our news and public affairs director is Reginald Hardwick, and production assistance by Steve Mork. Dialogue's theme song is by Lamont Holden. Dialogue is a part of Illinois Soul and Illinois Public Media. Join us for our next dialogue, Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul, and Wednesdays at 8 p.m. on AM 580.